You are listening to another Screenfish one-on-one, this time live with actor Dirk Blocker. Dirk is best known for his role as Hitchcock on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which returns on NBC on Thursday, January the 10th. In this one-on-one, we get to talk about the surprising and exciting fan campaign to bring the show back from cancellation, what makes the Nine-Nine so special, and Dirk's foray into the world of writing. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Thank you so much for calling me, Dirk. It's a real pleasure.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. Not another thing.
I have to say first that I am a huge fan of the show. Absolute huge fan.
Excellent.
I'm so glad that the show is back. I mean, that the fan campaign was something that is so rare, but I know after the cancellation at Fox, it brought NBC to the table. What was that process like for you and the rest of the cast? That must have been a real ride.
It certainly was. It was a big emotional roller coaster. Pretty much everybody seems to feel the same way about it. You know, I was able within an hour or so. I was shocked at first, but then after a while, it didn't take me long. I've been in the business long enough to know nothing lasts forever, and I kind of accepted it because I thought, well, we've had a great run. We have nothing to complain about. We've done over 100 episodes, and we're lucky. We're among the lucky people. My biggest regret was that I didn't really have a chance to say goodbye to people. Because we all thought we'd at least come back to do enough episodes to say goodbye. And at any rate, it wasn't long before that, before I started hearing all these other talk about Netflix and this and the other. So it was hard not to get your hopes up, but I kept trying and telling my wife, we got to try not to get our hopes up. My wife, on the other hand, we were on vacation. My wife, on the other hand, it's interesting. She just had this intuition. She said, you're not going to be canceled. You're going to be picked up by NBC. And I said, wow. I did a little husband's planning. I said, honey, it doesn't work that way. The business isn't like... and then I kind of turned my phone off because, like I said, we were on vacation. I just thought, I've had enough. I don't want to even think about this anymore. So I was a little late to the table because when I turned my phone back on the next evening, I had dozens of emails and messages. Dan Gore and other people saying, please look at your email. Oh my God, comment on this. And by the time I saw that, I was late, but I was in a restaurant and I literally whooped. It was quite an emotional roller coaster. And it was really, the lovely part about it for most of us, I think, too, was that it's kind of like in theater, you give a live response, you know exactly how people feel on the set. We know when things are working, when we're all laughing and when the crew's laughing and this thing and the other, but you just don't know what's on the other side out there, right? in the world. And to see the reaction that people had, the passion that they had behind it, was an awakening, and a lovely awakening for me at least, to see how many people out there really, really, really care deeply about the show. So it was a great roller coaster ride, but it was a roller coaster ride.
I'm sure it must have been. And I hear what you're saying about the feedback, because that must be reassuring to know that, everybody's sad when their favorite show dies, but the fans, they militarized.
they definitely did, and we had some people from unexpected places in our industry, as you probably know. We had some kind of heavy hitters. They sounded like fans too. They were like, No, you can't do this. This is my favorite show. You got to bring this back, blah, blah, blah. And that certainly didn't hurt a thing. We knew that we had a core of fans. We had really good responses on social media and so forth and so on. So we knew we had a core out there. I just don't think we understood how deep that pool was of fans that we have.
There's such a unique attraction to the Nine-Nine. And I've even heard some people citing that it's the only show on TV where every character seems to like each other. I was wondering what you think it is that makes the series so special.
Well, I think that that kind of taps into one of the. I mean, I don't know for sure, but my sense is that you know, there's a lot of alienation and loneliness in the world, and feeling of separateness, and you know, and this is a group of people who aren't blood related, but really behave as loving family members. I mean, we're all completely different. We know how to push each other's buttons. We do push each other's buttons and this and the other. But in the end, we all love each other. And that, and I think that that comes through. And the writing is so strong in that regard. Dan Gore and his writers have really been strong about that from the first episode on. And it kind of harks back to Parks and Rec, which is the same group of people, Mike Schur and Dan Gore and some of the core writers there. Chelsea Peretti was one of the writers, in fact, on Parks and Rec, you know, so there was that. It kind of led into this, and I think that that's just a part of how they operate. That's who they are as people. They do care about people. They care about us. They've made it clear from day one. And people in the crew, same thing. Everybody, they care about people. They treat people well. And so that sense carries over into the script writing and then onto the set. And the casting director of the pilot and then the episode, the series, I think she just did a miraculous job. She just somehow put the right ingredients together, because really from day one, everybody just, we just bonded really quickly.
Yeah, it honestly, it is, you can just tell that the entire cast is involved and just generally having a blast when they're on there and caring for one another. It's really exciting to see.
Yeah, it is. It is a ton of fun. It really, I mean, I don't want my bosses to hear this, but it's not like work. It's a playground. It's just so much fun. I mean, all the work comes before you arrive. We do, you know, you everybody comes prepared, but once we're there, it's just like kids in a sandbox. We're just having a blast.
Yeah, you know, one of the things about the show that I've noticed is Hitchcock and Scully are often used in the same breath. You know, when they seem interchangeable, but they're not. I was wondering, what do you think sets Hitchcock apart?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, he's saying that it seems like we could be the same person. The crew actually refers to us as the twins. Okay, bring the twins in, you know, that kind of thing. What sets Hitchcock apart from Scully, I would say, is that really kind of what you're asking?
Yeah, exactly.
Or Hitchcock apart from anybody?
Well, from Scully or from the cast, yeah, absolutely.
Well, primarily from Scully, because there are so many, we're so many similarities, we're so much alike. But, you know, Scully is kind of a, I see more as like a clean freak, even though his body parts are constantly referred to in the show as being odd and weird, but he doesn't see them as odd or weird, and he's kind of meticulous. If you know, his desk is just so, and everything is put just in its right place, and he's constantly darning socks and trying to fix things, and he's really into that kind of, whereas Hitchcock is just a hedonist, you know. I mean, really, it's all about pleasure. And I do think that one of the things that we kind of brought to the table when we started out, there wasn't a whole lot of information for us about Hitchcock and Scully, because they were so focused on trying to make the main cast gel and kind of figure out what they were all about. So a lot of that was kind of left up to Joel and I. And I think that what we brought to the table was the idea we gave ourselves was that maybe we had always wanted to be cops, so we became cops as young guys, and then we were good at cops as young guys, and we were badasses basically, but over time we kind of got tired of it, and we kind of started thinking, well, you know, we spent all of our youth dreaming of becoming cops, and now as we're getting older, it's like we're dreaming of becoming kids again. So we kind of just allow ourselves to, you know, just become childlike, really, in a lot of ways, and our temperament and our appetites and everything else, there's just like there are no rules really for us.
And he, if I'm right, I believe he did hold the arrest record until at one point.
He Well, some of that I think was in Hitchcock's own mind. Nonetheless, Mr. 99, as I said in that episode, I'm Mr. 99. Yeah, but a lot of that was based on the fact that in the early years, I tagged a lot of bad guys, that's for sure.
You know, can you talk a little bit about the show's social voice? There's a really interesting thing about this show. It's almost progressive. The way it's assembled, it's cast, it's very diverse. You've got an African-American gay, captain who's involved in a long-term marriage. And it's just, I was just wondering why you think that this diversity and this is sort of embedded in the show, in the show's DNA. Why is that so important for it to build around?
Well, you know, I honestly don't believe that these guys set out to say, let's make this that. I think they focused on the humanity and the human beings involved. And it just so happened that Captain Holt is gay. Hmm. But in other terms, there's absolutely makes no difference whether he's gay or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have two Latina actresses. These incredibly talented people, Melissa Fumero and Stephanie Beatrice. And from what I learned is that there was initially only one role written for a Latina actress. And so Stephanie and Melissa both showed up, and I think they both thought, God, I hope I get it, because, one of us is going to get it, not the other. But they were so taken with Stephanie's, I believe it was Stephanie's audition, they were so taken with it, they thought Melissa was the right choice for Amy. But when they looked at Stephanie, they just said, let's just make her Rosa, as opposed to, I've forgotten, the girl's name was Jenny, or I'm not sure what the character's name was to begin with. But so I don't think that they really thought in those terms. Don't know. They just found out that I think they wanted the best people available for the job. And Andre is proven to be the most incredible stone-faced, robotic actor. I mean, when he wants to be. And Terry Crews' enthusiasm, and he's so huge as a human being, I don't think that they were thinking, this guy's got to be African-American. I think they just said, we want the best actor and the funniest person for this role, and Terry was the guy. Wow. And so on and so forth. When Joel and I started out many, many years ago, the opposite was true. Most shows had, five, six, seven Caucasian actors in a show, and which I was lucky enough to be cast quite often, and Joel, the same with Joel. But it was always troubling and bothersome to notice that the one or two, sideline characters, kind of like Hitchcock and Scully kind of thing, were generally portrayed by minority people representatives. And so I view it as a very healthy and very positive spin that the industry and our world has changed to the degree that now the two main Caucasian guys in the show, Andy, of course, is the lead, but I mean, we're considered the punching bags, means that all the bad things that would need to happen to somebody in the show generally tends to happen to us. or if they have a joke that's just too radical and too offensive, maybe, for any of the main characters, just let's give it to Hitchcock or Scully. I view it as a very positive thing, but I don't know how much of this was really something that they sat down. I mean, they said it in Brooklyn. Yeah. And Brooklyn is, as a melting pot, America can be too, but Brooklyn is really a melting pot. I mean, there are different nationalities and backgrounds all over the place. So I think they were just trying to be honest to that.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And actually, I love what you're saying there. That's fantastic. I know we're starting to run out of time here, but I also heard you published a book, so I'd love to hear about that.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I did. I'm really pleased with it. I wrote a fable. It's a short fable, and I wrote it a couple of years ago. And my wife was so taken with it. I dabble in writing. I don't consider myself a writer because I don't sit down and write 4 to 6 hours every day like a real writer does. I write when I'm in, when the impulse strikes me. But I do tend to write a little bit here and there. Every week I do some writing, but it just helps me kind of figure things out. It kind of helps me if I can kind of identify what's going on in my psyche through expressing myself through writing, then that just helps me. So I've never really done it as a vehicle for, you know, I'm an actor and that's and I'm happy with that. But I wrote this one piece a couple of years back, and my wife, who is my staunchest critic and also my most loyal fan, she's both, she's just totally honest. She doesn't mince things. And for the most part, she's very positive. But once in a while, she'll say, yeah, you've done better. At any rate, when I got through reading this to her, because it also helps me to read things out loud to hear them, when I read this to her, she was very moved emotionally. She was just moved by it. She just thought it was a beautiful piece. So I was grateful for that. But she said, no, you got to do something else. You got to do something with this. This is not just something your usual stuff that you write and just kind of stash in a file somewhere. This is something I really want you to focus on. So when Brooklyn Nine-Nine came around and I was a regular and this and the other, I found myself in a position. At first we kind of went the usual route, which is through a literary agent who felt confident that he could help find a place for it to be published. But as I started investigating the world of publishing, I realized I was going to be giving up a lot of my creative control over it. And also, I had found an illustrator to go. It's an illustrated fable now.
Oh, wow.
I found an illustrator that I loved, and I was told, you know, basically, whoever does this, whoever publishes, they'll have their own illustrator. And I said, no, I want Eric. Eric is Eric Scottness is his name, and he was in the art department on our show, and we became kind of friends, as I have with almost all the crew people. But there was something about him that I thought just somehow he's a gentle soul. He's a gentle, sweet person. And I just thought that's what this book really represents. I don't mean to like toot my own horn too much, I hope I don't sound too egomaniacal.
No, not at all.
It really focuses on compassion that we have and lack of compassion that we can tend to have towards each other, and the power that compassion for each other can bring out in each other. Forgiveness is one of the themes. Bullying. There's an aspect of bullying that other kids don't treat this young, the main protagonist, they don't treat him so well. And there's also the idea that, this is kind of something that I've thought about for many years, is that, you know, when we say, God, how can people mistreat each other so readily? Sometimes we just find that, you know, how can someone be so blasé about being violent with someone or some such? You know, it's like, wow, what is that? What part of humanity is that? What is that all about? I don't understand it. And it started to occur to me that unless and until people could view the same kind of outlook in terms of how we treat animals, that, you know, we don't really have much hope for how we treat each other. You know, when I was growing up as a kid, it was like, treat him like a duck, kick him, you know, beat a dead horse, all these kinds of sayings that were all about just the fact that we didn't really recognize animals as having any traits other than just food sources and, you know, some and enjoyment watching them or doing it. But hunting, you know, I don't want to get into a big thing about hunting because I respect the idea of people providing food sources for their families. I have no problems with that.
Right.
But when I see people, pay large amounts of money to go out somewhere and shoot endangered animals to hang on their wall, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
But kind of in the same realm of someone who just gets into an argument with someone and decides to, you know, well, screw it, I'm going to kill this guy or try to. It's kind of the same vein. So there's that in the book as well. You know, science has shown over and over again, the more we investigate a different species on the planet, the more we understand that there's an understanding and communication and things of this nature in the animal kingdom that we're just now beginning to understand that, oh, you know what? These animals aren't dumb animals. These animals have their own level of intelligence that maybe we don't understand. We're so arrogant that we assume they're just, you know, dumb animals. But in actuality, that's just not the case in almost any area that I've seen investigated. So there's that in this story as well. So, it's, like I say, it's a sweet, and hopefully it's a story that will, have, you know, give people a brighter look on life and just kind of give people a lift, I hope. And that's the feedback I've gotten. I've gotten some lovely letters from people who bought, who purchased the book and have contacted me to tell them that it really made a difference in their life. And that was part of why I wanted to do it as well. I just figured, you know, I used to teach school when I was in between acting jobs. I was a substitute teacher.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of the times, my job, as far as I was concerned, was just trying to help people kind of figure out to listen to people and to be there for them. So at any rate, this story, I think, touches on our purpose of life. Are we here to do something, to accomplish something, or what? What is the deal? And I believe every person in the planet has some gift, and it's our job, I believe, to try our best to kind of uncover what that gift is. It may take us a lifetime to do it, but if we do, I think that we can add something of value to the planet, and we can have a better life.
That sounds amazing. Now, is the book available on Amazon? Like, can you get it through that?
It is available on Amazon. It's just become available on Amazon. It took a while because, again, I'm self-published, and I didn't do it through Amazon, so they make you jump through extra hurdles and so forth and so on. But it is, yes, now available on Amazon. It's also available on its own website. The name of the book is Master and the Little Monk, and if people want to go to masterandthelittlemonk.com and order, if you wanted to order it there, it's perfectly fine. I've had a lot of people do that, but there's also a comment section or a way for people to communicate with me on that website, and if they were to ask for and specify who they wanted it signed to, then that's also something that can be. That I can't do that through Amazon. I can only do that through the book's website.
Okay. Well, we'll make sure that we have a link on the podcast page and on the interview page as well, so that people can come. Yeah, that would be great. It sounds like an amazing story. It sounds like a really lovely and encouraging fable.
Well, that's essentially the way I see it. I tend to think the people I've talked to who read it, they seem to feel the same way. I'm very proud of it.
Dirk, honestly, this is a real pleasure. I genuinely am so grateful for the chance to chat with you. But just before we go, I realized I didn't ask you this, too. With the plans to sign with NBC, is the hope that it'll continue, or is that this
well,
will
that's,
be...
A... That's the never-ending hope of every TV show that's ever been on the air, I think. You know,
that's fair.
Until they've done 20 years and they're sick and tired of it. that's certainly... all of us we just love this job. It's just the greatest job in the history of the world, so the longer it runs, the better as far as we're concerned. But it seems as though that's NBC's desire as well. Everything we'll find out, I guess, when they start airing it, how well
sure.
It's received. But NBC has made no secret of the idea that what they really like to have happen is they'd like for this to extend beyond this season 6 that they've granted us, and maybe it's 7th or 8th or, you know, who knows, but one step at a time. And all we're focused on right now is just making the best possible season 6, and I think people are going to, if you're a fan of the show, I think people are going to freak out over season 6. It's really, there's some interesting and great things, and there's more social commentary, but not it's never been heavy-handed. It never is heavy-handed. There's no preaching going on here. It's all done in the guise of humor, but nonetheless, not ignoring the fact that there are issues in the world today that might be worth people reconsidering or considering for the first time. And there's a special episode, the second episode, which airs the 17th of January, 2 weeks from today. It's called Hitchcock and Scully, and it's the origin story of our characters. I have not seen it, nor has Joel, but we've talked to quite a few people, some of them journalists who came out to do some publicity for the show. They've all seen it, and the feedback we've gotten pretty much across the board, and in one or two reviews that are coming out now, is that it's really a sensationally funny show, episode. So, anyway, a lot to be proud of, a lot to be excited about, listen, I appreciate your time as well. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much. That's very nice to say. So we're looking forward to the show. Show's back on the 10th. And I'm sorry, the title of the book again? I just want to make sure I got it right.
That's okay. I appreciate it. The title is Master and the Little Monk.
Master and the Little Monk.
And the website is masterandthelittlemonk.com. Cool.
Thank you so much, Dirk. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks. Have a great day.